finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I was a Klonopin, or clonazepam, addict for 9 years. Decades ago, long before I learned about psychiatric corruption, and still longer before I found out how it happened, my psychiatrist friend Albert advised me to use this medication for anxiety. He told me over dinner, "You are a Klonopin person, Robert." My friend's wealth always impressed me, and I assumed his patrician confidence reflected a matching erudition. I must have been conjuring the Yiddish proverb, quote, "With money in your pocket, you are wise, and you are handsome, and you sing well, too." It was a time in my life when I unskeptically believed in medicine, a time during which I became a heavy Prozac prescriber after reading Peter Kramer's Listening to Prozac. It was decades before I learned that my diagnosis was mercury toxicity from dental fillings. Like everyone else in medicine, my friend tried to treat a symptom rather than the root cause. Last year, I wrote about psychiatrists and mercury in Judas Dentistry. The book citations in this post are free downloads. Quote, "Psychiatrists are drug pushers proffering elixirs they claim cure 1,000 ills. Sorry, I exaggerated. Only 450, quote, diagnoses are found in their billing Bible, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM. To fabricate these, American Psychiatric Association members, paid handsomely by pharma, cast votes. These, quote, physicians claim that, quote, disclosing their financial conflicts of interests fumigates this bribery. The psych diseases concocted by these shills are expressly designed to be, quote, treated using pricey patented drugs. Pharma supplies half of the Food and Drug Administration budget, just as they pay the doctors, so their approval is a rubber stamp. Finally, massive disease-mongering campaigns run by the corporate ad agencies convince us to use the purported remedies. Since the drugs are all highly addictive, little persuasion is needed after that. This, quote, mental health industry has persuaded over 25% of Americans and 80% of Danes to swallow psych drugs. Monthly shots are forced on others. None of these medications has been proven effective. They numb us, addict us, and cause violent suicide and social dysfunction. The proof is that, just like every vaccine, the jackals running Big Pharma never ran tests of their pricey nostrums against placebo controls. Studies lacking this vital metric are nonsensical. When the authors publish, they prove their work is a scam, the journal editors admit they are accessories, And the companies confess they are ringleaders in a racketeering conspiracy. The FDA blinds itself because it's paid off. All the people involved are murderers for the drugs or killers. And that's the end of the quote. Before he prescribed Klonopin, my friend referred me to another shrink. This fellow was not at a loss for words, and his muddy torrent of them included an attempt to convince me that the benzo class of drugs was more harmful than SSRI, quote, antidepressants. At the end of our session, he tossed me a grab bag of colorful SSRI samples and a few other related drugs that were in fashion at the time. I tried it all, but my body sensed brain damage each time, so I trashed them. For more details about SSRIs, see their chapter from Butchered by Healthcare, which I reproduced in the parting shots. It puts a flamethrower on these drugs. And so I went back to Albert, and he taught me the hard way about benzodiazepines. He prescribed 100 clonazepam with 5 refills and told me not to worry about addiction. I described these drugs in Butchered by Healthcare, quote, the benzodiazepines, Valium class drugs, relieve anxiety for a few weeks, but after about a month they stop working. After this, patients require higher doses to produce the same effects. Later, if the drugs are discontinued, months of agonizing dread, sleeplessness, and crippling nervousness commonly occur. The original studies of Xanax for anxiety were 14 weeks. After 4 weeks, it was working. After 8 weeks, it was not. And at the end of the study, as the experimenters withdrew the drug from the patients, they got much worse. The psychiatrist and the drug maker ignored the longer-term results and claimed a net benefit based on the first 4 weeks. And I have a link to Robert Whitaker's YouTube post about this. The FDA approved the drug, and it became not only the most commonly prescribed benzodiazepine, but the most frequently prescribed psychiatric medication. But Xanax is addictive, and most physicians are well aware of this by now. Other benzos are also problematic to discontinue. Klonopin is a chemically similar drug. One patient I worked with had used this 17-hour benzo to sleep it every night for a decade. He decided to stop it. I wrote a compounding pharmacy prescription for smaller and smaller doses, so he tapered it over 3 months. He suffered from anxiety and sleeplessness the whole time, but felt better at the end. He said his energy and creativity had both improved. That patient was a composite that included me, and I was addicted for 9 years. Since the drug lasts over 17 hours in the body, I would feel a little fuzzy but functional in the mornings. Although those taking benzos tend to escalate their dose gradually, I peaked and stabilized at 2 milligrams every night, which is considered an intermediate dose. Heavy users take up to 8 milligrams every 24 hours and still want more. Many combine it with alcohol. Last year, another surgeon asked me for advice about quitting his habit of 20-some years. He had read my book and had the same pattern as me. It took months of sleepless nights, recurrent anxiety, and tapering doses for me to get off the damn stuff. Theoretically, a compounding pharmacist can give you 6 months or more of gradually decreasing doses to make this less painful and aggravating, but you must admit your problem to someone who might rat you out to the state medical board. What I did was cut it down in stages. I was eventually able to convince myself that my free-floating withdrawal anxiety was unconnected to anything real. Ultimately, I manned up for a few more months and was done. My final perspective after these experiences and my reading was that benzodiazepams were horrible, but benign compared to the other psych drugs. The SSRI antidepressants cause violent suicide, brain damage, and far more severe addiction. The atypical antipsychotics cut 10 to 20 years off people's lives. In a rational world, no psych drug would have ever been improved. None had been adequately studied. Postscript, another addiction. People compliment me on my smoky baritone podcast voice. A decade of cigarettes was how I acquired it. During the same period as the Klonopin, I started smoking at the counsel and encouragement of my climbing buddy, Herb. Quitting these was more aggravating than quitting my favorite benzo. Herb still smokes. The good news is that if 10 or more years have gone by since you quit, your chance of dying of all causes are the same as people your age who have never smoked, and I have a reference. I am hoping for the best after this decade of foolish risks. My story is nothing. The following is excerpted from an article by Christy Huff, MD, from her website, benzoinfo.com. She has been through a related addiction and withdrawal. And then this is a quote from her website. Christine Ann Norlach passed away on June 16, 2017, at the age of 48 after a long struggle with benzodiazepine withdrawal syndrome that ended in suicide. In April 2015, she was prescribed 1 milligram of Ativan, which is lorazepam, which she took 3 times daily for symptoms of anxiety and tremors resulting from hyperthyroidism. She was not given informed consent at the time of prescription that the drug could cause physical dependence and severe side effects, or that it was not intended for long-term use. Initially, Ativan helped the symptoms for which it was prescribed, but after 2 months of taking it, Christine developed a new cluster of symptoms. She was now in tears most of the time and experiencing the inability to sleep and think properly, losing weight, having episodes of horrible fear and terror, burning nerves, episodes of severe pain, and thoughts of suicide. She became unable to drive or care for her husband or her home. She visited multiple physicians who could not diagnose the cause of her problems. She became increasingly suicidal. Knowing her life was at risk, she admitted herself to the hospital under the care of a psychiatrist, hoping she would be helped. She was promptly diagnosed with a, quote, nervous breakdown, generalized anxiety disorder, and fibromyalgia. The psychiatrist decided to stop the Ativan abruptly, assuring the Norlach family that this was safe. What ensued during that hospital stay was not any relief, but instead a rapid onset of mental and physical torture that Christine would endure for the next 21 months. Within a day of stopping Ativan, she had severe skin burning from head to toe. The next day, bright lights appeared before her eyes, combining with a feeling that her head was exploding, followed by a loss of consciousness for 30 minutes. When she awoke, she could barely walk for the next several hours, and the nursing staff ignored her pleas for help. She was released after 6 days in the hospital on a cocktail of risperidone, now that's an atypical antipsychotic, gabapentin, that's a failed drug that was only approved originally for postherpetic neuralgia, and hydroxyzine, while still suffering horrific symptoms. 2 days after discharge, she sought help again in the emergency room where the ER doctor diagnosed her symptoms as benzodiazepine withdrawal, noting in her chart that she had not been tapered from the drug. For the next 21 months, Christine continued to suffer. One of her most severe symptoms was akathisia, a state of inner restlessness with outer movement that compelled her to pace the house for hours on end. Her husband, Mike, was highly supportive and understanding of her situation, and he did all he could to help her. As a caregiver, it was difficult for him to feel so helpless, knowing that nothing could be done to make it better. Every day, he saw her forehead scrunch up in a wave of painful symptoms. She would break out in a sweat, tremble, and cry. He remembers thinking how lonely and trapped she looked. On the night she died, Christine sent a carefully worded letter to a rarely used email account. Her words made it clear that the relentless nature of the withdrawal symptoms led to her to end her life. Other references. My interview with a person I met who suffered akathisia and psychosis after a brief SSRI use is here, and I've left a link. My post about how SSRI antidepressants cause almost every mass shooting because of their akathisia side effects is at another link. And, viewer discretion advised, I left another link about my post about David Carmichael murdering his young son while under the influence of an SSRI. The Canadian justice system eventually released him and I met him. MISSD, an akathisia awareness foundation, was started by my friend Wendy Dolan after her husband committed suicide 2 weeks after starting Paxil. That website has lots of information and I'm a donor. Now here's my pitch. If you have friends who are being butchered by psychiatry, this post and butchered by healthcare can help them. Please sign them up for Surviving Healthcare. And if you have a few extra dollars, send subscribers my way. Number one parting shot, my psychiatrist friend Albert. He is an expert witness for the California Workers' Compensation System, a network of expensive, senseless, prolonged litigation, primarily benefiting lawyers and expert witnesses. He testifies about whether people have permanent psychological damage following industrial injuries. After 30 years of observing the scene from both the plaintiff's or patient and defense or state sides, he says about half the plaintiffs are fakers. He says the insurance industry would rather spend more on litigation than recognize disability and fund timely care. Many cases are held up for years, which can be disastrous for those with genuine health issues. Even though this delay runs up the ultimate cost of settlement, when the companies keep the money longer, they make more overall because they invest the withheld cash and get high returns. Like the other players in the system, Albert works it. He has 40 employees and contractors and bills the WC insurance companies at his lucrative physician's rate for some of his employees' work. He claims this is a, quote, gray area. His income is $2 million a year. He works 20 hours a week, and he requested anonymity. We are now out of touch. Next, I have attached another chapter from Butchered by Healthcare that describes the workers' compensation apparatus he works in. It is the second most corrupt healthcare delivery system. Download it to learn the worst one. Parting shot number two, the Prozac and Relatives chapter from Butchered by Healthcare. I wrote about 1,000 Prozac-type SSRI prescriptions over my career, which might have been $500,000 in drug sales. I screened my patients as I was trained by merely asking them a few questions. Peter Kramer's best-selling Listening to Prozac, published in 1997, duped me. He said Prozac could save patients from common symptoms of guilt, fatigue, sadness, sleep disturbance, and even aches or digestive problems. He also claimed it could be a lifestyle drug similar to today's Viagra, boosting ordinary people's performance. I learned later that SSRIs are toxic, have limited utility, and the hype has produced vast overuse. Industry marketed SSRIs as an improvement on the older tricyclic antidepressants. These cause sedation, and only a month's supply is needed for suicide. Part of the promotion of Prozac class drugs was that sleepiness is mild, and even enormous doses rarely cause fatality. Before the drug era, doctors thought depression was rare and most often self-limited to about 3 months. When this was written in 2020, Wikipedia claims that 17% of the U.S. population becomes depressed during their lifetimes, making them all candidates for expensive, indefinite medication usage. legions of paid wiki contributors, many of whom work for pharmaceutical companies, make this source only a little better than a drug industry link farm. A simple checklist is used to diagnose depression. A primary care medical assistant often administrates it. It is a list of non-specific symptoms from the DSM. Many are opposites. Here it is, the DSM criteria for depression. Depressed mood most of the time. Lack of pleasure most of the time. Significant weight gain or loss. Appetite up or down. Slow or speeded up thoughts and movement. Feeling worthless or guilty most of the time. Either fatigue or excess energy. Cannot think or concentrate most of the time. Thinking of death or suicide with or without a plan. So no physical tests exist to verify the diagnosis. After waiting 2 weeks, doctors might commit a patient to these drugs for years or even a lifetime. The industry promotes the disease, the medications, and the casual approach to the treatment together. Quote, Prozac is not addictive, according to the package label written by the manufacturer. True, there are no opioid-type withdrawals. However, after discontinuation, severe anxiety and depression are common. Other issues include suicide, feeling, quote, electric shocks, and tardive dyskinesia, TD, which is often manifest by continuous mouth movements. The drug companies claim most of this is because the depressed state itself, rather than medication, is the cause. There were many consumer complaints to the Federal Trade Commission about these claims that antidepressants were not addictive. When my patients sometimes stopped the SSRI drugs and had symptoms of depression and anxiety, I believe that it was their disease and not the drug withdrawal. I was told that they must use the medications long-term for them to work, so I told everyone to continue. It was bogus information, however. The SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, name was pseudoscience dreamed up in the marketing department of SmithKline Beecham. The, quote, chemical imbalance in the brain idea was the brainstorm of a sales copywriter in the 1950s. Knowledge of serotonin and other neurotransmitters was even more sketchy when Prozac was invented than it is now. Today, the seductive but mythical gibberish embarrasses researchers. Similarly, quote, ACE inhibitors or angiotensin-converting enzyme blood pressure medications were gobbledygook names for branding purposes. Lithium is an old therapy for bipolar illness with no sparkling pseudoscientific story associated with it. It is not patented or a moneymaker, so no one would pay a copywriter to invent a marketing idea. Note, lithium causes sedation and occasional tardive dyskinesia. It becomes toxic in doses only slightly higher than therapeutic ones. This can cause permanent brain damage. The marketer said depression was like diabetes and SSRIs were, quote, an insulin for brain disease. However, no clear relationship of depression to serotonin or other neurotransmitters was ever established. And the drugs all work about the same, with a similar lack of benefit. Jill Moncrief, in her book, The Bitterest Pills, confirmed this. Quote, no chemical imbalance or other biological process that might explain drug action in a disease-centered way has been substantiated for any psychiatric disorder. Most authorities now admit that there is no evidence that depression is associated with abnormalities of serotonin or noradrenaline, as used to be believed. There's also little empirical evidence for the dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia. Ron Pies, editor-in-chief emeritus of the Psychiatric Times, agreed. The, quote, chemical imbalance notion was always a kind of urban legend, never a theory seriously propounded by well-informed psychiatrists. It was a myth. Despite this consensus, nearly everyone still believes the metaphor and parrots the message. The idea is, one, your brain is damaged. Two, the drugs fix something. And three, you need to take the medications indefinitely. SSRIs cause substantial harm. A 2017 literature review of randomized controlled trials in Frontiers in Psychiatry said these drugs are ineffective and damaging. It linked them to osteoporosis and movement disorders, including akathisia and tardive dyskinesia. They may double the risks of miscarriage and congenital disabilities. However, physicians use them off-label for pregnant women and during breastfeeding. Expectant mothers get severe withdrawal symptoms just like everyone else. Sexual side effects occur in a range from 2 to 59% in various trials. In some studies, they never ask the patients about the issue. When used for premature ejaculation, about a third of men permanently, quote, improved, sometimes after just a few pills or even a single dose. This suggests significant long-term effects that are adverse for most people. Many patients report having long-term problems with having orgasms after taking and then stopping these drugs. In the first 9 years of Prozac's use, between 1988 and 1996, there were 39,000 FDA complaints, a record for any drug. This included reports of suicide, psychosis, abnormal thinking, and sexual dysfunction. Many patients taking the medication have sexual difficulties, are, quote, emotionally numb, and have, quote, reduced positive feelings. In October 2004, the FDA introduced a written warning about suicide in children and adolescents treated with SSRIs. The agency extended this in 2006 to include young adults up to 25. Industry hid SSRI-related suicides and violence. The manufacturers have always claimed suicide was because of the underlying depression and not the drugs. They altogether avoided addressing violence, and the psychiatrists parroted this. Even Dr. Healy believed it before he worked as a plaintiff's expert in the Stuart Dolan case. So did I. Healy changed his mind after he read the secret corporate documents produced by the defendant corporation during the lawsuit's discovery process. Dr. Healy learned from his review that Lilly concealed suicides. Their executives have written internally that they could, quote, go down the tubes if we lose Prozac, and that a single big news story could do it. In 1985, a Lilly internal memorandum said that the increased suicides were 5.6 times greater than those associated with imipramine, an older antidepressant. Gercha later evaluated a 2006 FDA meta-analysis of 100,000 patients and estimated that it underreported suicide by a factor of 15. SSRIstories.org has thousands of news clips about SSRI violence. Martha Rosenberg summarizes, quote, "The only thing more shocking than the number of newspaper stories on the site is the number of previously healthy people who committed violence with no precipitating events. 20 people mentioned here set themselves on fire. 10 bit their victims, including a biter who was sleepwalking and a woman on Prozac who bit her 87-year-old mother into critical condition. 3 men in their 70s and 80s attacked their wives with hammers. In Midwest City, Oklahoma, a woman accepted a cup of tea from an elderly nurse she'd just met and then strangled her. A 12-year-old boy left in his cousin's car while she stopped at Target killed her 5-year-old daughter, who had also been left in the vehicle. All were under the influence of psychoactive drugs. Did events like these ever happen before the psychoactive drug revolution? In 1 month of reports on the site, a 54-year-old respiratory patient with a breathing tube and and an oxygen tank, and no previous criminal record, held up a bank in Mobile. An enraged man in Australia chased his mailman and threatened to cut his throat for bringing him junk mail. A 58-year-old Amarillo man with no criminal history tried to abduct three people and killed an Oklahoma grandmother in the process. A 60-year-old grandmother in Seattle killed three family members and herself. And 14 parents drowned their children, a crime no one had ever heard of before.